Understanding the Author's Intent was presented by David Crabtree on November 4, 2003, at McKinsey Study Center's Tuesday night class. This is the sixth talk in part one of a series entitled Doing Christianity. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2003. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
My topic is understanding authorial intent. This is an important topic. It's a topic that is of current interest, and it is a topic on which we at the Study Center come down on the minority position on this particular perspective. The majority view is that the authorial intent of a written work cannot be recovered. That is certainly the view at in academia. That would be the dominant view down the street at the university. But as I say, we here take a minority view on that. We believe that the authorial intent can indeed be recovered. But I'm going to be talking quite a bit about this, and I would like to bring you to the place where you have some doubts as to whether authorial intent can be recovered or not, so that you can feel the force of this issue. I'm going to address three questions. The first one is, can authorial intent be found in writings? And I will be spending most of the time on that. Secondly, if so, then who is the relevant author of an inspired work? And thirdly, can there be more than one level of meaning in a work? So the first one, can authorial intent be found? Let me see if I can describe this very simply, in very simple terms, right at the beginning. If I'm successful, then the rest of what I have to say will make sense. If I'm not successful, it won't. So I need to be successful here. Here is the problem. Language is a very flexible thing. Think about it. Language provides us with a limited number of words and a limited number of syntactical devices, syntactical constructions. So I have limited tools that I'm working with. But with those limited tools, I can say an infinite number of things. That's a truly remarkable fact, that you can say, you can express an unlimited number of ideas with a limited number of tools. Language is truly remarkable. But in order for that to be possible, language has to grant me, has to be used very flexibly. We all make use of that flexibility all the time. If you look at a dictionary, look at a word like, I'll grab one at random, chair. What does chair mean? My suspicion is if you looked it up in a dictionary, there would probably be about four entries. Because I can think of three right away. A chair is something that you sit in. A chair is someone who presides over a committee. Right? A chair is a position, a financed position at a department in a college. And there's got to be more. But just those, we've got three meanings you would find in the dictionary. But even the entries that you find in a dictionary don't cover the ground. For every different kind of chair, we're using the word chair differently. We have one kind of chair here. It's one with holes in the back so you can lift it up. And there's, in the next row back, there are chairs without the hole in the back, so you can't lift it up. So there are different kinds of chairs. And there are other kinds of chairs. There's another one. Do we have any others? We can go around the building and find other kinds of chairs. So the word chair with that meaning has a great deal of flexibility. So when you take into account the meanings, the nuances, the connotations, every word has a lot of meanings, has myriads of meanings, ways that it can be used. And we could do the same experiment with syntactical constructions. They too have myriads of uses. Okay, so language gives us a lot of flexibility, and as speakers, we rely on that. We're always putting words together in different combinations in order to communicate a new idea, a different idea. All right. As a listener, when I hear something, a statement in language, then I have to... Let me back up just a second. As a speaker, then, I have an idea. And what I do is use the tools available to figure out a way to put those words together such that you, the listener, have the best chance possible of recovering that idea. That's the nature of communication. Idea reduced to words so that the listener can hear the words and reconstruct the idea. That's how language works in principle. So as a listener then, you hear the words, and your job is to reconstruct the idea that gave rise to those words. Now that's a tricky task. You are going to come to any statement with what's called a pre-understanding. That is, there are certain things that you expect from that statement. You have a world view, you have expectations, and all of that has a huge influence on how you reconstruct the meaning out of the words that you have heard. So if I make a statement, you're going to go to your brain and say, what is that likely to mean? And then you're going to look at the words and the syntax and see if you can construe it in a way that's consistent with what you think it is likely to mean. So what you come into the interpretation process, assuming is likely, you will find. So you see the problem. The problem is, because your expectations shape the way that you interpret it, and because language has so much flexibility, you are likely to be able to interpret it consistent with your pre-understanding, then your pre-understanding is just reinforced by the interpretation that you create. Does that make sense? So the problem is, one can get stuck such that whatever is said to you doesn't really penetrate the idea that gave rise to it, doesn't penetrate you. You just take the statement, interpret it according to your pre-understanding, and nothing has penetrated your brain from the outside. You've just reinforced your pre-understanding. That's the problem that those who don't believe in authorial intent are pinpointing and saying that authorial intent cannot be found. Let me give you some examples. I got a whole bunch of them. The first one is one that I suspect that everyone here has experienced. It's one of those situations where you go to a Bible study that's attended by people from a variety of different theological backgrounds, and you're working through some passage, And let's say that you do this over an extended period of time. You do it weekly over several months. If you've been in that experience, you know what happens. That when people share what they understand the passage to mean, it starts to fit into a set pattern. That is, they will always find the same things. And after a while, it gets to the place where you can predict what they'll say that this passage means. And if you've got people from diverse theological backgrounds, you'll start hearing that same theology coming out, no matter what the passage is. I was trying to think back to my days in college when I attended such Bible studies and was trying to reconstruct what kinds of theological backgrounds were there and represented different perspectives. And I was able to remember three. I could have remembered more, but I have a bad memory. The first was a Ron, what I considered a Ron Sider Christian. I don't know if anyone remembers Ron Sider, but he had a number of books in which he advocated social justice. That is, every Christian should be committed to caring about those who are in need, who have material needs. And we as Christians have an obligation to live simple lives so that we can share with the poor. So in my Bible study, there was a Ron Sider type Christian, and it didn't matter what the passage was. Somehow, that person would understand it to mean that here, once again, we are being told that we need to live simple lives so that we can share our money with the poor. A praise the Lord Christian. This is the one for whom theology doesn't matter. Theology is a problem. It's not an aid to our Christian life. And so whatever the passage says, the important thing is that we don't fight over it and that we remember that just honoring the Lord is what we need to do. And if we give honor to the Lord in everything that we do, then all will work out well. And then there's the political conservative Christian who believes that traditional American values are the apogee of the Christian life. That somehow in American tradition, in our day and age, or maybe a couple decades ago now, that Christianity took on its ideal form. And so reading a passage with someone like that always reinforces, once again, why we should be patriotic and vote Republican. What is interesting about those kinds of Bible studies is no one's ever convinced of a different view. That you come together and you share your ideas. Everyone is generally polite, but no one is dissuaded from their view. They go away with their view only reinforced. Well, that means that in a Bible study of four with different theological backgrounds, the Bible is saying at least four different things. So is authorial intent possible? If you've ever talked to someone who has a significantly different theological perspective than yours, and you tried to persuade them of your theological perspective, and you can open the Bible and go to various passages, and you can say, but it says here, da-da-da-da-da-da. If they are well-read, if they are well-versed in their theology, they will always have a comeback. But that can mean, but that can be taken to mean da 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 da, which is just the opposite of what you have told me. If you've ever been in that kind of conversation, you realize how frustrating communication is. Maybe authorial intent can't be found. Let me give you some further anecdotes that authorial intent can't be found. If authorial intent can't be found, then communication cannot work. Right? Okay. Let me just give you three examples from my experience. First of all, as a teacher, it has been apparent over the years as a teacher that my ability to communicate is not as good as it ought to be. I don't do as much lecturing now as I did in past years, but I can remember very distinctly a number of situations in which I had just given a lecture and someone would come up afterwards and ask a question, which made it clear that they had missed the entire point of my lecture. Now, that could very well be my fault and not the listener's fault, but the issue is communication is difficult. We had, when we first started Gutenberg 9 years ago, we had 5 hours of lecture per week on historical background, tracing through the history of Western civilization. We discontinued that because what we discovered is at the end of the quarter when we gave the exams, the amount of information that they had retained out of those 50 lectures per quarter was minuscule. Communication doesn't work. In my marriage, you're laughing too soon. In a marriage, they say that the key to a good marriage is communication. Well, that's disturbing because communication is difficult. There have been times when I have dearly wanted to communicate my ideas to my wife, and she dearly wanted to find out what those ideas were because they were inscrutable. But it is frustrating when you find yourself in a position where you cannot put your ideas into words that can communicate to the person you most want to hear those words, make sense of those words. Once again, communication doesn't work. My wife studied art. And her preferred genre, she painted, and her preferred genre was abstract expressionism. And in their painting classes, they would all, having created their works, they would all critique each other's work. And she said that consistently, when the other students would critique her work, the meaning that they would derive from her paintings was always sexual in nature. And she said, but that wasn't what I was doing. But that's what they always found in it. So she became convinced art cannot communicate. There's a story about a psychologist who had a client, and he decided as a part of the therapy he was going to the Rorschach test where they do the ink spots? So he had a series of ink spot pictures that he showed to the client. He showed the first one to the client, and he said, what do you think of when you see this? The client said, a naked woman. Showed him the next one. He said, what do you think of when you see this? And the client said, a naked woman. Showed him another one. The client said, naked woman. Another one, naked woman. The psychologist broke it off and he said, I've never seen anything like this. You are obsessed with naked women. And the psychologist and the client said, but you're the one with all the dirty pictures. That was my wife's experience in art school. Now let's go to academia, where this is really a live issue. This has come up with respect to Gutenberg College in a couple of ways. That is, in academia, it's believed that authorial intent cannot be found. We designed Gutenberg as a great books college. The first great books college was St. John's, which was started in the 1930s. The curriculum was designed by Mortimer Adler. And the curriculum is designed to develop in the students sound learning skills and basically a well-rounded liberal arts education, all founded on the reading and discussing of those writings which have been the most significant in the formation of Western culture. And those are sometimes called the great books. So students read the great books and then discuss them. Now, as the curriculum was originally designed by Mortimer Adler, there is not designed in the curriculum any study of history. We have patterned our curriculum after the Great Books curriculum, but we have made a few changes, and one of those changes is to introduce the study of history and to weave that into our curriculum. Purists in the Great Book tradition don't like our improvements. Their perspective is that the great books transcend time and culture. They are of such a nature that you don't have to know the historical context, the historical background that gave rise to those particular works. They transcend culture such that you can read them without knowing the historical background. And their concern is that if you teach students history, you cannot teach them what really happened, because what really happened cannot be recovered. So you can only teach them a version of the past, some kind of understanding of the past. And whatever understanding of the past you teach your students, that will shape their pre-understanding. And as we talked about before, their pre-understanding will then determine how they interpret the book. So the fear of the purists is, if you teach them history, you are essentially telling them how to interpret the great books. Therefore, it ought not be done. When was it? A year and a half ago, we had, in process of accreditation, we had a site visit. And a site visit, that's a way for accrediting agencies they send a team of academics to the college to observe how it operates, to look at the documents, to just explore the whole institution, to see if the institution is worthy of accreditation. We had a site visit in which three academics came and spent time attending classes and talking to faculty and students. At this site visit, one of the members of the site visit team, very early on in the visit, became quite concerned about the way we go about interpreting texts. As part of Gutenberg College, we have a rule that all the faculty of Gutenberg College have to sign a statement of method. And the statement of method is an explanation of how you come to know truth. It's basic principles on how you come to know truth. It's things like truth exists, that truth is can be rationally ascertained, that we can use our reason to come to truth. And it includes the Bible as being a source of truth in the statement. And that we have to understand the Bible by reconstructing the author's intent, intended meaning. Well, this person, this one academic, was quite concerned that we would require all of our faculty to sign a statement that says that the goal of interpreting the Bible is to recover the author's intent. And he asked, well, do you apply this method to other works of literature besides the Bible? And as a matter of fact, we do. We do. So he said, in the classroom, would you insist on finding the author's intent? And we replied, yes, as a goal of interpretation, yes, we would insist on that. And his response was, that's too restrictive. There are other ways of interpreting. And what you're doing is restricting the imagination and the creativity of the students. And that's harmful to the student body. Here again, a skepticism as to whether the authorial intent can be found. He thought that our approach to interpretation was eccentric and stifling of the imagination and creativity of the students. Okay. So those are just some anecdotal reasons why one might call into question whether authorial intent can be reconstructed or not. How did we get here? How did we get to the place where people question whether communication can happen? Well, it all stems from the development of modern skepticism. And modern skepticism starts with David Hume. At least he's the one who gave modern skepticism intellectual respectability. Let me talk just briefly about David Hume and his perspective, and then I will look at what Thomas Reed had to say in response to it. David Hume wanted to figure out, how can we know that we know? What can we know for sure? Now, it would appear, as I look out at the world, I can know, for instance, that this, what should I call this, a lectern? It's an awfully fancy word for this. But that this lectern exists. What?
Don't we know?
No. I can know, it appears as though I can know that this lectern exists. I can see it, I can feel it. But David Hume says, no, we can't know it's there. All I can know is that in my brain, I have an image of a lectern. That in my mind, I have this image that the lectern is here, but I don't know that the lectern is here. In my mind, I have this impression, this sense, that I can feel the lectern. But in fact, all I know is that my mind is telling me that I can feel this lectern. I don't know for sure that it's here. So from David Hume's perspective then, what's happening is happening in my mind. I don't know if there's any connection between what's happening in my mind and what's out there. You could all be figments of my imagination. Furthermore, he says, we can't even tell, we don't even know for sure that there is cause and effect in the world. And he uses the example of billiard balls. I have a billiard ball standing here. I roll another billiard ball into it. When this second billiard ball hits the first, the second one stops and the first one rolls on. What we say is that the second ball caused the first ball to roll. Cause and effect. David Hume says, prove it. He says, I've never seen cause and effect, have you? I mean, you see the ball roll and hit the other one, and you see the other one roll, but did you see cause? He says, you didn't see cause. No one has seen cause. All you've seen is conjunction. That if you do that 100 times, that will happen 100 times. And you develop the habit of putting them together, and you call that cause and effect. But you don't know that that's cause and effect. As a consequence, David Hume's philosophy undermines our ability to know anything that's outside of us. All that we know is that we've got images flashing through our mind, sensations flashing through our mind, but that's all we know. We can't know more than that. Thomas Reed, David Hume, by the way, was writing in the late 1700s. Thomas Hume came along with a response to David Hume. And his perspective is, let's restore a little common sense to this. No one doubts whether stuff is out there. No one doubts that when they see the lectern, that they're seeing something that's out there. Whether it's a little child or whether it's a grown adult, everybody assumes that the lectern is out there. In fact, we can't really, truly believe otherwise. If we really, truly were in doubt as to whether the things that we see that are out there are indeed out there, we couldn't conduct our lives. We'd be hit by a truck that may or may not be there. His point is, if you really doubt whether the things that you see are out there, the things that you sense are out there, then you'll be in an insane asylum. That would be the only appropriate place, because you have truly lost touch with reality. Thomas Reed says, then, the really important philosophical question is, why is it that we assume that there is stuff out there? Why is it that we have the faculties of making contact with what's out there? And why is it that that is what's compatible with life, whereas skepticism is not compatible with human existence? That's what's really interesting. He argues that we are born with hardwired into us. We have the equipment that is necessary for us to be knowers, to perceive what's out there and to make sense of it. Furthermore, to demand logical certainty of all that we know, that's unreasonable. That's what Hume was doing, demanding logical certainty, that it was beyond any logical doubt. And Hume says, what can we know that's beyond logical beyond logical doubt? Virtually nothing. Only trivial things. Very few things can be known with logical certainty. But we all know to be certain things that don't have logical certainty. We all know, for instance, that this lectern exists. We all know that we ourselves exist, etc. So what Thomas Reed is doing is he's saying, let's bring common sense into this. And common sense, meaning that which every human being has to believe, that which every human being is made to accept as true and can't live life otherwise. It seems to me that the same kind of common sense needs to be applied to the issue of whether authorial intent can be found. That it is a branch of the same skepticism that has led people to doubt whether authorial intent can be found or not. There is no question but what communication is fraught with difficulty. And the insights of those people who challenge whether authorial intent can be found or not are worth listening to. They are raising issues that are significant. Nevertheless, of course communication is possible. Of course authorial intent can be found. We all assume that every day of our lives. We are born with the ability to acquire language. As human beings, that is part of our constitution, part of our makeup. Without effort, as a child, we learn language. And we communicate with that language. And we learn to send and receive communications constantly. Even those who are the most skeptical about authorial intent, they write long treatises using language, trying to communicate to us the inability for anyone to reconstruct authorial intent. Something's wrong there. Even they assume that language works, that authorial intent is possible. So what the critics have done is just blown the problems out of proportion. There are problems, but that doesn't mean that authorial intent cannot be found. Now, the problem of pre-understanding is a very important one, and it's one that we need to take note of. That problem of us bringing an understanding to the text, an expectation of what the text is going to tell us, and then because of the flexibility that language has in it, we find a way to interpret it that reinforces our pre-understanding. That happens. They're right. But what they're saying is the pre-understanding determines your interpretation. That's not true. The pre-understanding influences your interpretation, but it does not determine it. That if one is careful and looks at the language with a lot of integrity and a lot of patience, you can see that if you have a wrong pre-understanding, it is not going to map onto the words of the statement nicely. And what you're going to see is some resistance. You're going to have to force some things to make it work. If you're sensitive to that, then you will make adjustments in your interpretation. And as you make adjustments in your interpretation, then you're finding something in the statement that you had not expected. And that then changes your pre-understanding. So it's not a closed loop in which your pre-understanding is always reinforced, but rather your pre-understanding affects how you interpret, but if it doesn't quite fit, you have to adjust your interpretation, which then allows you to adjust your pre-understanding. It evolves. So it is possible to make progress if you have integrity and patience and are willing to do so. The key to communication is not really all that mysterious. If you have a communicator who works hard to put his ideas into words that communicate that idea, and you have a listener who works hard to reconstruct the intended meaning from those words, communication can happen. And it happens all the time. It may not be possible in a large, let's say a large work, for us to recover absolutely everything that the author intended. That may be true, but we can recover it substantially if we devote ourselves to the task, and if the author has communicated as best he's able. Okay, so I would argue authorial intent can indeed be found, at least substantially be found. Are there problems? Absolutely. But nevertheless, it can be substantially found. Now, the place where this becomes most problematic is in fictional literature. When we were discussing this with this member of the site visit team, this academic who was concerned about our method of interpretation, he said, well, what about Dante's Divine Comedy? Would you say that there is only one intended meaning, and that meaning that the author intended is recoverable? And we had a long discussion about that, because he was of the opinion that it cannot be recovered. And oftentimes, the perspective of one who would argue this is that in a work of literature, the literary work kind of takes on a life of its own. That through the process of inspiration, the author is writing stuff that has meaning that he hasn't intended. That he is writing stuff that follows from what he has written before, and it just kind of takes on a life of its own and creates itself. There is not an authorial intent that is guiding everything in the work. And therefore, a literary work is pregnant with meaning. It has lots of meaning, and not all of that was intended by the author. There are two things that I would have to say with respect to that. One is, I don't believe that a work takes on a life of its own. I am not a creative writer. I wouldn't claim to be one. I have done a little bit of creative writing. At least I thought it was creative. I have done a little bit. And I do know the phenomenon that they're talking about. And that is, you get going a kind of, I don't know how to even describe it. But you'll be working on it, and all of a sudden you'll see possibilities of where you could go with this that fit really well, and where you could go with this other part, how you could develop this character, how this could happen. And it's like you've been working and struggling to try to get something that's interesting, and then all of a sudden all these pieces fall together and you write as fast as you can. I mean, I've had that experience. And so I know what he's talking about. But I would still say that as an author, I was in control of that. That it was my intent. My intent was changing as I wrote. I would acknowledge that. That there's a sense in which some of my intent changed as I wrote. But it was still governed by my intent. Secondly, I think it is true that in a work of fiction, that the intent can be very complex and multifaceted. That's true. I acknowledge that. But it's still intended and is, at least in principle, recoverable. And thirdly, we need to make a distinction between the meaning and the significance. That the meaning is what the author intended to say. And that, I would argue, is one. But the significance can be beyond number. Let's take just one example. Let's say that the weatherman said, it will rain tomorrow. The meaning is clear. Tomorrow there will be liquid precipitation. The significance could be different for every person in this room. The picnic has to be canceled. Can't go to the baseball game. There are all kinds of significances that may follow from that. But the meaning is one. And I would say, with respect to fictional literature, that's particularly true, that there are lots of significances. And those, it is true, those are outside of the control of the author. Those are dependent on who you are and your experiences and what you bring to the text. Okay, so I would argue that even in fictional literature, there is authorial intent, and that that meaning can be substantially recovered. Okay, that was the first of the three questions. I got two more to go, but they're shorter. Who is the relevant author in the case of the Bible? The Bible presents a particular problem, a peculiar problem, in that the Bible is inspired. So there's this God superintended the writing of the Bible, but it was written by a human author. So there's a sense in which there are two authors. And the question is, which authorial intent are we trying to recover when we are interpreting the Bible? Now, either last week or the week before, I argued that in inspiration, that as I understand it, what is happening is God has so superintended the process that the intended meaning of the human author coincides exactly with the intended meaning of God. The two are the same. If that's true, then it doesn't matter which author's intent you try to recover, because they are the same. However, we are practiced in recovering the intent of the human author. It makes sense to make that our goal. So I would argue what makes the most sense is, in interpretation of the Bible, to try to recover the meaning intended by the human author. Are there levels of meaning in the Bible? Is it possible that there is the meaning intended by the human author, but there is a whole other meaning, that is the one intended by God, such that in the same text you would have two different meanings being conveyed? Is that possible? It seems to me it's theoretically possible. The problem, however, is that we know the rules by which we would recover the meaning intended by the human author. That's normal human communication. We know how that works. We know the rules. We can do that. By what rules would you recover the other meaning? And even if you could list the rules by which you would recover that meaning, how do you know that those rules are the ones that need to be applied? in the absence of some reason to think that there is another set of rules that will help us to get to that other meaning, then we're just guessing. Okay. There were a couple other issues that I thought I would get into, but I guess I won't. Okay. So what I would argue is that the goal of interpretation, the proper goal of interpretation, is the recovery of the author's intended meaning. The Bible was written as normal human literature. God chose to do it that way. God put His communication in human form, in much the same way that God chose to reveal Himself most fully in human form, in the form of Jesus Christ. So the Bible is a very human thing, and it makes sense that it's a very human thing. We understand it as normal human language. What's divine is the content. So the goal in interpretation is to reconstruct what the human author was trying to say. Okay, questions or comments? Do we have a mic to run around?
Okay, my question is, according to the thing with the authorial intent, is if someone had a different idea of what the author intended from whatever had already been established to some degree, would that be said, no, that's wrong, that kind of thing? Or was that maybe more what the person was worried about who came for the accreditation? I'm not sure if this is making sense.
Let me see if I can... You have two people who disagree as to what it says?
Yeah, two people are disagreeing on what the author's intent was. They're not disagreeing on... I mean, they're probably disagreeing on what it means to them also, but they're...
Right, what I would call the significance.
Right.
But they disagree on the meaning.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
What would be the response to that at Gutenberg?
That, in principle, if you had two very reasonable people who could put their pride and stuff aside, in principle, they could get together and they could go through the statement word by word and examine it to see which of the two proposed intended meanings best fits the language. And in principle, that should be discoverable.
Yeah, but I'm saying there wouldn't be a problem with someone coming up with a new idea or anything. I mean, if someone had a new idea and wanted to express it, and there would be that room for a debate to figure out which one was correct. It wouldn't
absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. Good. Because
that doesn't seem to stifle creativity. I was wondering where the person was getting the stifling of creativity.
But it's within boundaries. That was the concern, was that they thought the boundaries were too confined. But absolutely, one can become content with an interpretation too easily. That is to say, you think that you have construed all of the words correctly, and you become satisfied with it, and you are blind to the places where it doesn't really work very well. It is very helpful to have someone else say, I don't know if that's right. Even if you end up deciding that your interpretation was right in the first place, it's always helpful to have someone raise questions with respect to your interpretation that you hadn't considered. Because that's the way that you can break free of an interpretation that ultimately doesn't work. And that's the way that you can become more certain of the interpretation that you have. So that's a very helpful thing. That's not a problem.
I was wondering maybe if that was what they thought was going on, the people who were coming to working on the accreditation and having concerns. I wonder if maybe that was one of their concerns.
Their perspective is that if you're focusing on recovering the author's intent, that is a, those are two narrow parameters.
Okay.
That you're keeping the bounds of creativity and imagination penned in, and that they need to be unleashed. Another question.
Could you maybe describe some of the particular difficulties we have with Scripture regarding it being in a or specifically the New Testament being written in a language that's no longer spoken, and how do we reconstruct that language in order to have access to the text?
Mm-hmm. Obviously, that does create difficulties. A language where, a dead language, so there are words that, well, we have enough writings in Greek that we can create fairly good dictionaries from the context that are available. Hebrew is a little bit more difficult. There are words there that we don't know, that we don't have other occurrences of them in Hebrew. So that's one problem. Another problem is the words that we do know, we don't know all of the nuances and connotations of. You can't go to a native speaker and talk to them and find out, well, when would you use this word and when would you not use this word? That creates difficulties. There's no question about it. Are those insurmountable difficulties? The nice thing is the Bible's a pretty big book. If all we had of the Bible was Philemon, we'd be in trouble. Because there are passages that, because of our lack of knowledge of the language, particular words, they present big obstacles in reconstructing the meaning. And I think there are passages in Scripture that we may never be able to recover. But fortunately, the Bible is a big enough book that many of the ideas that are presented many times. And as a result, as a whole, we can come to a very good understanding, I would say, of the Bible, despite those particular difficulties. And the difficulties, as I say, it seems to me, are larger in the Old Testament than they are in the New Testament. We do have translations of Greek into other languages that are old and yet helpful in reconstructing meanings of words, etc. There is they stopped. There's a big dictionary of the Greek language, classical Greek language. This is classical. The Bible's in Koine, but they're related. By Little and Scott. And for a number of years, that was regularly revised. They stopped revising it about, was it 30 or 40 years ago? They stopped revising it because they foresaw the advent of the computers, such that it is possible now they have a project ongoing to put all of the existing works of classical Greek into computer-readable form. So now you can do a search and find every occurrence that we have of a given word. And so that's going to change the way that studies of classical Greek are done. Another question.
Mm-hmm. It seems to me that a great work of literature would have to be bigger than the author. And so even though it would seem primarily important to seek out the author's intent, that a great work would be bigger than that person. And I can't remember where now, but I was in some letter or something by C.S. Lewis. He's thankful to some person that read his book because they had come up with some interpretation he hadn't thought of when he was writing it, but he agreed with that interpretation.
Mm-hmm. My question there would be, are they saying, is it an interpretation that is different, or a significance? Let me give you an example. And I think this is probably the kind of thing you're talking about. If you, let's say I write a novel, and I've got character development, and I am portraying their lifelike things, the kinds of things that I've actually seen. If I'm portraying lifelike things, it is quite possible that someone could come along and read that and make a connection that I did not consciously make. But I would not say that that is a meaning that is other than I intended. That I have, what I've done is I've taken reality as I understand it, and I've tried to capture it and portray it. I'm not going to even understand all of the interconnections that are present in my portrayal. I think that's true. That's going to be the case. But my presentation as a whole, that's what I intended. Does that make sense? Do you understand what I'm talking about?
Yes, but it does seem rather grandiose for the author.
What do you mean?
That the author would know or in some way be able to predict those interpretations or to assume them?
No, I don't. What I'm saying is I don't think they will be able to necessarily. If the portrayal is complex and lifelike, I don't think the author is going to be able to, is going to be consciously aware of all of the connections that could be made. But the portrayal is the one intended. So the distinction I'm making is, yes, that's the portrayal I intended, but it didn't occur to me that that character is, for instance, exhibiting the exact same character flaw in a different form as this character. The author may not recognize that in advance. But the portrayal is the one that was intended.
I certainly agree with you. Interpretation is not a matter of flight of imagination. For example, the Nehemiah rebuilding the walls of Jerusalem is not an allegory of the Holy Spirit rebuilding the human personality. You know, that is just using it as metaphor. However, the scripture does say that the life of David is a type of the Messiah. And in that vein, I really believe, for example, again, when you put the references to Mephibosheth and 1 Samuel together, they really portray eschatologically the relationship between Messiah and the individual disciple. So what number one, what do you think about that? And number two, if there are double meanings, and you know, certainly there are because the scripture points to it in David, and you can see obvious places where allegories are made, what principles would you apply to know when and when not, when you know you're just taking off on your own flight of fancy, and when it's legitimate?
Well, I would say that even in those cases, there's only one intent. In we can talk about typology in just a second. What was the other thing you said at the end? Oh, allegory. That we are only justified in reading something as an allegory if there's some indication by the author that it is to be taken as an allegory. If we just decide that we are going to interpret something allegorically, how do we know that's what's being said? Dostoevsky, I can't remember which novel it was, but one of the novels that he wrote was interpreted by critics at his time as being an allegory. And they said, well, this stands for this, and this stands for this, and this is what happens here, and da-da-da-da-da. And Dostoevsky wrote a response to that saying, that's garbage. I intended no such thing. And he says, if you choose to interpret something as allegory, you can interpret something to mean absolutely anything.
Yes, I would wholeheartedly agree with you. However, to prod you just a little more, the writer of 1 Samuel certainly did not give that indication when he wrote about Mephibosheth.
Okay.
But you do have to wonder why a person like that would be treated in a book like that. You scratch your head and it is so obvious that it leaves one who sees the obvious and wants to take it for what it does say to him. Okay, well, what exactly where do I go with this? I know, I feel safe confidently myself because David was an allegory of Messiah. But it leads me to where when I am conversing with someone, expressing that there is one intent, the author's intent, God's intent, with or without the human author's intent. How do you guard against saying, "Oh no, it's just an anecdote. You can take it. You know, it's what the Spirit speaks to you, and so forth."
Right. That's the problem. So I would argue there is only one. Even in those cases, there's only one intent. In typology, the way I understand typology as it's used in the Bible, is it's patterns of behavior on the part of God that we're seeing. So there are people who, in a sense, prefigure Christ, but it's just God writing history and writing it in such a way that it foreshadows what's coming. That God did the same kinds of things back then that he does in Christ. So it's not a double meaning as such. It's just God prefiguring in history what he's going to do later on, foreshadowing.
Okay, so that leaves a lack of concreteness. But heck, I'm perfect guardian anyway.
Well, we would just take something like Noah and the flood. There is an instance where God visited judgment on the earth, but saved one. Saved one in his family. That's the kind of thing that God does. And that's what we see there. That's the kind of thing that God does. We don't know from that story how God is going to do similar things in the future, but it's not unreasonable to think that God would do similar things in the future. And in that sense, it's typology.
How can we as a reader know the difference whether or not we've come upon a meaning or a significance?
Well, the meaning is what you know. You have the meaning when you could go to the author and say, "Did you mean to say X?" And you could reasonably expect the author to say yes. Significance is some extrapolation from that. Oftentimes, based on my experience and what I come to the text with. So, for instance, my simple example, the weatherman, it's going to rain tomorrow. The meaning is that it's going to precipitate the next day. If I ask him, did you mean that I shouldn't go to a picnic tomorrow? Well, he'd say, that's not what I intended. That's not what I said. But you may not want to go. The distinction is difficult, but obviously there are situations where it's trickier than that. But in principle, a line should be drawable, I think.
Is part of what Tim meant when he was asking that question, I mean, with the Bible, obviously you cannot go to a biblical author and say, is this what
right.
you meant?
Mm-hmm.
But wouldn't it be if you could be fairly confident that you had the biblical author's intent if you could go to his language and account for all the details of the language and it fits with your interpretation? You don't have the author there to say, what did you mean? But the best we could do, I want you to comment on it, but the best we could do is to be able to account for all the bits and pieces of his language and how he put them together and make them coherent
right.
somehow.
Right, right. Let me give you one example. Something like the sun rose yesterday. Let's say in the text it says the sun rose yesterday. Some people would argue, well, that's making a statement with respect to the nature of the movement of the sun and the planets. And that's just going beyond that. The statement in the Bible that would say something like that, if that's not integral to what is being, to the story as a whole, then it is probably not making a claim of that nature. And if it's not making a claim of that nature, then if we ask the author, did you intend to say that the sun rose as opposed to the earth turned, the author's going to say, doesn't matter to me. That wasn't my point. That wasn't part of my argument. It's in those situations where you can make a distinction between what they intend to say and directions that it could be taken other than the intent.
David, I was going to ask if you notice, getting back to sort of the theme of the term about doing Christianity, have you noticed in Christian culture that there's a movement toward, or maybe it's the same as you've always seen it, there's always still the people like Reed in Christianity that would want to use common sense and in your view, authorial intent, and there's probably still the ones that want to use mysticism in their Christian walk to decide whatever would fit the biblical interpretation. What's your assessment of the church as a whole and their attraction to your value of authorial intent, and you see it moving towards or against, or it's kind of at the same place? Because it seems to me that if you're in a place where Hume was in your Christianity, that you can actually know nothing until it's just somehow mystically spoken to you.
Right.
But that would wind up being real vacuous.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm. I don't know that I'm in a good position to answer that. I don't know that I have a good feel for what's happening out and about. My vague sense is that in general, in Christian culture, the Bible is being taken less seriously now than it was 20 years ago. on the one hand. But on the other hand, there is a segment of the Christian culture that is growing, that is taking the Bible seriously, and more seriously than they did 20 years ago. So it seems to me there's a divide that's happening that is more pronounced now than it was a couple decades ago. But I don't know if that's an accurate perception or not.
I'll be quick. Okay. My question is there anything wrong with expounding on someone's significance if they read a passage and they don't think it's the author's intent, but it's something that might fit with what the author maybe could have, I mean, the author maybe would have agreed with it. It's kind of like when a preacher gives a sermon and then gives an application.
Right, right.
Is there anything wrong with that?
Right. Well, there would be two kinds of significances. One is one that flows right out of the intended meaning, and then I'd say, great. There's another kind of significance that doesn't flow out of the intended meaning. It's just something that occurred to someone while they were studying the passage, but it has nothing to do with the passage. Well, the problem there is we don't know if that's standing on authority. That the intended meaning is authoritative. A rightful significance that flows out of that is authoritative. But a significance that is not attached to this, who knows whether that's authoritative or not? How would you even assess that? That's the problem. It may be helpful stuff, but it has to be assessed differently because we don't know whether it's authoritative or not. It's kind of standing on its own. Does that make sense?